on the road or off-road, Chevy Silverado is built for tough performance in any condition. Hit the road in a new Silverado pickup. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for a dealer near you. Chevy Silverado, official truck partner of the Chicago Bears.
You see the black smoke in Los Angeles? The people angry? The SEIU union and others who are anti-Trump demanding that the Immigration and Naturalization forces don't carry out federal law to boot illegal aliens from our country. They don't want federal law, and they're fighting for it. And then you see the black smoke and the guys on motorcycles waving flags. They're not American flags. That's not the red, white, and blue. That's the Mexican flag. And that's all you have to see. That's what this is about. And where are we? Is this an inflection moment where society realizes where we're going? Or is this a Bolshevik, Menshevik moment where the unions stand in front of federal law to fight Trump as civil order breaks down? Will it cost them anything in the elections coming up? To talk about all this, we've got Charles Lipson, our dear friend, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, author of many books and articles, and you can find all his stuff at charleslipson.com. Jeff Carlin is here. Jeff Carlin, executive producer, WGN Radio is here, and so am I, John Cass, 40 years columnist, newspaper man in Chicago, not always a columnist, but enough, trying to give you common sense, a dose of common sense at least, when you subscribe to johncastnews.com. And you? And where are you? As all this is happening, you're out there watching the riots in Los Angeles, the burning of Oakland, the revisiting of the Summer of Love, and Abrego Garcia, and the Supreme Court is afraid. You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago Way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
The Chicago Way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
As promised, Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago. The country's fallen apart. Remember those halcyon days of 2020 when we all lived together and we loved together and we tore the country apart together? Remember that?
You're remembering your teenage years, aren't you, John?
I'm going to skip the sarcasm here. There's nothing like the destruction of the empire to draw my attention. And out in Los Angeles, they're fighting against the unions, and the leftists are fighting against the ICE agents who are trying to deport illegal people. And they don't want it. So the SEIU president gets arrested. I'm wondering why. Why would SEIU be involved? Oh, my God. They might be leftists, too, right? I guess. What do you say to that, Charles?
Well, first of all, John, I'm shocked you use the term illegal immigrants. These are just undocumented people. Yeah, they forgot their documents somewhere. Right. It's unclear where. But once they find them, I think everything clears right up. It's really striking here that we're seeing the George Floyd riots again with probably the same backers. But I think that the Trump administration, this is an 80-20 issue. It's possible for local governments do not have to assist the federal government in carrying out immigration raid. But it is a felony for anyone to obstruct them. And I think that that's not only what these private groups are doing. It may not be legally provable, but I think that's what Karen Bass, the mayor of Los Angeles, is doing. When ICE agents were being assaulted, they called for LA police to protect themselves, not to hurt. It took 2 hours for the police to arrive there. And I think sending in National Guard is perfectly appropriate. I think it's more complicated to send in U.S. troops to maintain order, more politically controversial, because we don't like to see the U.S. military enforcing domestic law. Now, they can keep domestic order, but I think it's more problematic. I'd like to see the National Guard. Now, and I don't know the situation where where Governor Gavin Newsom, I haven't heard him on any of this.
He doesn't know what to do. Like
he's out looking for more hair gel.
This guy is on every issue. You mentioned 80-20. He's on the 80-20 of everything, like women in sports, men in sport, women, girl spaces. Yeah.
They also have a big problem with a so-called rapid transit line where
how many billions of dollars are spent?
Billions. Yeah. And it was authorized in 2006 or 2008. It was supposed to be completed by 2020, and they've hardly completed any of it. And the cost is, of course, you know, more than quadrupled, and the federal government has said we're going to stop sending money. I have an additional complaint about a lot of projects like that. That's a route. By the way, Florida completed on its own dime a route from Orlando to Miami, and paid for it itself. Completed. It's losing money, but that's Florida's decision. If a route goes from L.A., if its only purpose is to go from L.A. to San Francisco, why is that a national issue? Why should taxpayers in Nebraska pay for it?
It's insane.
In fact, the federal government's expansion in general to pay for local projects of all sorts is extraordinary. And so I would say, okay, there's a logic to paying for the lunches, maybe dinners as well, of children who can't afford it, even if they're all within a state of Mississippi or Alabama or Illinois.
Right.
But more and more local police are being funded by the federal government. Just everything, local schools, everything is now funded through the federal government. Trump's approach to that has been to say, that's okay, we're going to continue doing that. We're just going to turn more local control over how the money is used back to local governments. But it's all still going to go through Washington. And I think it's time for rethinking some of the federalism. But we've gotten away from the riots in Los Angeles. And I think those are a tectonic issue, both because the first duty of government is to maintain order, a lawful order. And the second duty is to maintain the border and to use taxpayers for people who are to use taxpayer funds for people who are in the country legally. This doesn't seem to me a hard issue. And yet it is a hard issue for every blue state.
It gets even harder, Charles Lipton, when we see that Service Employees International California Union, California President David Huerta was, quote, injured and detained, unquote, according to the Los Angeles Times, while documenting an immigration enforcement raid in downtown Los Angeles. I don't know why a union official would be documenting a raid, but he's of the left, and he clearly doesn't want immigration laws enforced.
Well, right. He probably has members. He has two sources of support, right? SEIU is one of the most left-wing unions in the country. Yes. And it may well have members who are illegal. And so he would have two reasons to do that. But I would say that this may be a case where RICO laws should be invoked for the people who are doing the funding of all of this and organizational support.
Where are we to go from here? Because I just see a replay of the Summer of Love 2020. It's the same thing you mentioned, the George Floyd playbook. It's out. Again, the same union, the same union's muscle, the same catastrophe on the streets. Do the people of America want to go through this again?
I don't think so. I haven't seen direct polling on that, but it's worth remembering that after the George Floyd riots, Trump lost the election.
Yeah.
So often when there's chaos, the party in power is held responsible. Now, you could say in Minnesota, the party in power was the Democrats, and they have a different name in Socialist. Minnesota, and the party in power in Los Angeles are the Democrats. But the needle that the Trump administration needs to thread here is restoring order without looking dictatorial.
So I guess that means they've got to take their masks off so that the Democrats can identify them, the ICE agents, and go to their homes and send the cartels to the homes and attack them there.
So I think there needs to be legislation to protect law enforcement officers from doxing, both federal and local. Their names can come out and may need to come out in trials. That's what people were saying. So if somebody claims that they were standing peacefully on the sidewalk and not doing anything, and a federal agent came up and beat them senseless, and that person brings a case in court and says the person who beat me senseless was this person in a mask, I think it's appropriate that the federal government has to disclose, or local government has to disclose, the name of the potential person. That person can be called on to testify and so forth. We may be able to protect that. There are people who testify and who can protect their identity, and that might be the case there. But just to disclose the names, which for the audience, it should be clear that the feckless head of the House Democrats now, Hakeem Jeffries, has said that he wants to expose every ICE agent, that they should not only take off their mask, but he intends to expose all of them. And of course, that's deeply threatening. We can get into the trouble that the Democrats are in, but it seems like, you remember the old Beatles song, you say yes, I say no. Every time Trump says yes, they say no. And the advantage of that for Trump is that he can get them on the 20 side of 20 issues.
It's a reflex now. It's so ingrained in everything they do that it just happens automatically.
Right.
And it's not to say, I mean, ICE agents, you know, it's a terrible mental image to see masked men with guns and, you know, showing up at schools and showing up wherever they are, showing up at businesses. But they're also, most of them are wearing body cameras. I mean, that's kind of a law that it's not all of them, but it's, you know, there's a growing number. It's a movement to increase that. So it's not like there isn't transparency in that sense. So if something goes awry or something is illegally done, you know, we can go to the tape. You know, that's kind of the whole idea, is that we don't want our police and law enforcement to, you know, just have carte blanche. And I get that. I go back into the SEIU thing. I don't understand this. And it's the thing that I don't think people, especially in Chicago, because it's Chicago and all things are local, all politics are local, the unions you know, they're not protecting the interests of their members anymore. You know, that's went out the window years ago. It's a political machine that's trying to seize power and control dollars and cents. A lot of them coming from the federal government, and that we've talked about is probably doesn't make any sense. But how do we roll back the clock on that without damaging the ability of groups to bargain collectively and try to do the most good for their members who are have a thread in common, as like they say, they're all teachers. But and that's a side note too. SEIU, these are groups that's like not just teachers, it's teachers, it's bus drivers, it's dishwashers. Those people who supposedly have something in common, but they really don't. I mean, is there a way to limit unions to just an occupation so we don't get this conglomerate that then becomes this political henchman?
Well, the best example of your very important point, Jeff, is in Chicago, where the most powerful, I think the most powerful union, not only in the city and in the state, but possibly in the country, is the Chicago Teachers Union. But let's say something about public unions are different from private unions in a very important way. If, let's say you're at Ford Motor Company and you're negotiating with the United Auto Workers, you have some overlapping interests and some conflicting interests. Because as an executive at Ford negotiating with them, you want to increase your corporate profits. You want to keep good workers. That means you need to pay them in a way that will keep them on the job and keep turnover low. And you don't want a long strike, right? So, and the union doesn't want a long strike, and they want higher wages. And as far as they're concerned, they could wipe out all the company profits if they could get a wage that high. So there's some conflict and some cooperation. That's not true with public sector workers. And it's especially not true in blue states where union support for Democrats is a critical portion of the coalition. Why is it different from the Ford Motor Company? But who is negotiating with the Chicago Teachers Union? It, even if it were not a former union employee, in the case of Mayor Brandon Johnson and the people he appointed to the school board, even if it were not him, the people who would be negotiating are people who depend upon or could conceivably receive union support, financial, door-to-door, campaigning, all of that from the union itself. So they have some conflict because the people, these public negotiators, still ultimately have to be elected. But they have a lot more in common with the union. So they are conflicted in a deep way because their election or re-election will depend upon union support, or could. So the more money they can give to the union, the better it is for them. That's just not true in the same way for the negotiations at Ford Motor Company. So we need to understand that there need to be, that's why Franklin Roosevelt.
Good point. I was just, yeah.
Franklin Roosevelt, who favored unions quite strongly, opposed any public sector unions.
That reason.
Right. I mean, his reason was just what I said, that if they went on strike, they could hold up not a private business, but all public works.
Right.
And that the people in the government would have a reason to play patty cake with them in order to get reelected. So I think that that public sector unions are a problem. Now, the and that's true even in some red states. Teachers unions are very powerful, even in a lot of red states. It's often the most powerful union in a state. So we need to think about ways that would protect the workers' rights without giving any political clout to the union. I'm not sure you can square that circle.
So That, where does that leave us? I mean, it leaves us, you know, running down, continually running down the rabbit hole, which, you know, Chicago is out front on.
Well, we've done some things. We've done some things. Nobody, no teacher has to join a union in order to be employed, right?
Janice,
and,
yeah.
And of course, the main effect of just the whole panoply of blue state laws has been to drive people to Tennessee, Florida, Texas, all these states where it's not just
Indiana.
Indiana. Yeah. Just look at Indiana compared to Illinois in terms of governance, and most of the downstate counties in Illinois would like to join Indiana, and that's true in states like Oregon. They'd like to join Idaho. It's true.
I don't want any more Democrats in this state. We got enough already. I'm right. Living in Lake County, Indiana now, which is, and I don't need any more Democrats here.
Right.
There's signs on the orchards that say, Illinois people, you don't bring your politics to Indiana.
That's really interesting because, of course, that's really true.
Yes, it is.
And all across these some formerly red states. I mean, it's been true in North Carolina. It's true in Georgia. You get it's true in the big cities in Texas, especially Austin. It's been true in California and Arizona, where people are fleeing California. California's had the first out migration, over in migration, if you leave aside illegal immigrants, since the gold rush. How can Gavin Newsom run on that?
Well, I guess he can't, but he's going to try. I mean, there's somebody's going to try. I mean, there's a lot of money in California. Most of the, we call them the bi-coastal elite, all their money, you know, comes out of California. The what is it called? That industry, the
high tech plus high tech Hollywood.
Industry. Right?
I think high tech has changed. I don't know that high tech, well, a lot of the people who are the coders and so forth, younger generation, they're very much on the left, but the people who own the businesses tend to look to the bottom line. And I think when they moved to support Trump, that was away from the Democrats. I think that was just a political calculation, you know, but it takes really bad governance to screw up a state like California. It takes really bad governance to screw up cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco, a beautiful city. San Francisco is trying to claw its way back, actually. It's got a new mayor and who's an heir to the Levi Strauss fortune.
Right, right.
And he seems to be more moderate. I mean, they don't have to be Republicans, but I think people are just fed up, and they're fed up with lawlessness. They're fed up with the illegal immigration. And one fact about the illegal immigration and the sanctuary city laws, which, as we said, local authorities don't have to cooperate with ICE, but they can't obstruct. That's the problem that these judges, like the Milwaukee judge, she obstructed. Or she is accused of being of obstructing, and it looks to me like that's exactly what she did. But when, if you cooperate, as they do in, let's say, Florida, then ICE can go into a jail. They have a detainer, which is an administrative document. On an illegal immigrant, and it says we can take you into custody. They then have those people in custody, then have some due process rights, but those due process rights are in a civil court that the federal government, that the executive branch operates in, not in a federal court in general. But when you prevent that from happening, then what happens is that the jail in Milwaukee or whatever lets the guy out. That guy is either caught fleeing the courthouse, which is time-consuming and manpower-intensive. You have to surround the courthouse. Or that you'd go on a raid to his house or wherever you think he's staying. When you go on that raid, everybody who is in that house, who is in the country illegally, is committing a crime, and they will all be taken into custody. That includes small children, for example. So it includes the spouse, includes the brother who's living there. So the blue states are putting all those people at risk of deportation in order to virtue signal that they won't cooperate. And they're also running into a coalition problem, which is that all states have only limited resources. So if you're in Chicago, government resources are strained between, you know, cleaning up the streets, paying for the schools, paying
for... Does the left want this? Huh? Does the left think, that this chaos that they're seeding serves their purposes?
Yeah, well, they don't if they live in a middle-class professional neighborhood or better. But African-Americans and legal residents who are Hispanic are the losers in this fight for government resources. And we've seen in Chicago real opposition to the sanctuary policies of the city.
Yes.
And this, and that opposition has come not from Republicans, who are a relatively small group in Chicago, but from African-American. Just actually, Hispanics outnumber blacks in Chicago. It's just that blacks have been organized for many, many more years and are far higher in their registration for voting. So Hispanics don't play as large a role, and most of the Hispanic representatives are left-wing in Chicago. Not all, but most. It's interesting to see what's going to happen to black representatives. They won't go against the, quote, sanctuary city laws, but they're going to be under tremendous pressure from their constituents to stop the funneling of resources, which have neared $1 billion in Chicago for to pay for illegal immigrant services.
Well, good Marxists like good is relative, but like Brandon Johnson, the Black Lenin of Chicago, he's doubling down. But what about the others? What about Kelly and Congressman Kelly and so forth? What are they going to do?
That's the issue. I think that they're going to be torn between the two sides. But I suspect that on the ground, aldermen who aren't already pre-committed leftists. What's interesting, if you're a progressive first and foremost, if you're on the left, you're going to stick with the sanctuary laws. But even at the expense of minorities. By the way, the biggest thing besides the immigration cleavage on minorities is the systematic dismantling of the DEI and affirmative discrimination laws. The courts have played a critical role in that. You know, schools like Harvard and so forth are still trying to discriminate. Harvard, this is unbelievable. Harvard now has a remedial math class.
Yeah.
I think we talked about this last time, Charles, and my jaws dropped, you know, the idea that the best of the best, with the exception asterisk, you know, DEI, is appalling. And then the Supreme Court recently, you know, kind of tweaked it that, you know, protected classes like, you know, say whites or men and women or whatever, you know, don't have the same damages availability, right? They can't be hurt by true minority groups, and that so that there's this.
The court rolled that back last week. A white heterosexual woman was discriminated against for a job by the person who did the hiring, who was gay and said she wanted, there's nothing wrong with her being gay, but nothing legally problematic about that. But she said she only wanted to hire gays, and that's all she did. And I don't know if she only hired gay minorities or, you know, favored them or whatever. Courts ruled, not just ruled, you know, 5-4. They right. ruled unanimously that that woman had a cause of action. I think it kicks back to the lower court to decide whether she wins the case. But they said you couldn't rule her out. She was discriminated against. That's basically what they said. Brandon Johnson is now in trouble for this because he went to a church and made a speech in which he said he prefers to hire black people. And then he went on to point out how many of his top appointments were black. And he said that's because they like other people better and they're just nicer and whatever his reasons were. But the point was, he said, I discriminate. And now the DOJ is investigating him. And the only bad news about that is that Chicago votes so much against the Trump administration that being sued by the Trump administration might actually help him. He has polling numbers that are 6%. As I always tell friends, they don't list his numbers anymore. They actually list the names of the people who still support him.
There are a few white or non-black candidates for mayor who are just so weak. They don't even deserve comment.
Right.
And then comes this guy who at 6% is trying to build on it so that in the negative, so that he might squeak in as the black candidate in the runoff and then rely on black racism to get him elected. That's where we are.
Right. And he has, as we said earlier, the Chicago political machine, as people in Chicago know, is dead. The people who put Mayor Daley the Elder in power, and that machine has now been replaced by the Chicago Teachers Union. It's the most powerful political organization in the state, and it doesn't just favor, you know, higher wages for its teachers, which means that it wants to elect aldermen and elect the mayor. It's an active political machine, and it can put up, you know, signage all over and so forth. And
Stacey Davis Gates, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I occasionally go to a lunch that is maybe 50, 60 people, of which there are three Republicans. So I listen
the contrarian.
How my main goal actually is to understand how they see the issues, and they divide between the national issues, from which I learn nothing. I mean, I know them well. And state and local issues, and they know them quite well. And some of the people there are extremely knowledgeable about things like budgets and so forth, which are a shambles in Illinois and even worse in the city of Chicago. But about a third of those people favored Brandon Johnson before his election. After about 3 or 4 months in office, there was only one person in the entire room who still favored him, quote, and I'm not even sure about her. She worked for the city and was not in a good position to say what her real views were. But basically all the people who had favored him now opposed him, and some were really vigorous in their opposition, saying that things like the teachers' union was now really a cult. It looked quite different from a normal union.
With over three decades of serving up streetwise insight and local perspective on Page Two, the voice of John Cass has a home at johncassnews.com.
There's a new sheriff in town.
This will truly be the golden age of America. That's what we have to have.
But as he settles in, can you deal with the hysteria, the meltdowns, the constant whining?
I don't know what to do.
You know what you need? You need a good cup of common sense.
It's just common sense.
Like the kind of common sense you get when you subscribe to johncassnews.com. I'm John Cass, 40 years a journalist in Chicago.
The Chicago way.
I opened this website, John Cass News, so that you could have a decent cup of common sense.
This great country of ours was built on its entrepreneurial spirit.
It's time that you join the frontier of independent journalism at johncassnews.com.
Subscribe today to get access to great columns from John Cass, Dan Proft, and others. Don't be a chum alone and subscribe at johncassnews.com.
Now we're back. And I just have one thing to ask you. The bromance. What do you think of that? The Trump versus Musk. Because I know Jeff has something to say.
Let's hear it, Jeff.
I'm not a fan of Musk. I never have been. You know, that's well documented. This is not out of line for him. I mean, I don't think he's – two things. One – you know, there's the budget analysis of that bill. We were learning late last week that it was flawed and that it may not be quite as comprehensively taxing on our debt structure and income, may or may not. We're waiting to see real numbers. I mean, it's a giant bill. So for anybody to really gauge it is going to be a large task to begin with. But that aside, I don't like either of these guys personally. You know, their styles are just not mine. They're very in your face and they're very troll-esque. You know, they want to get you to rise and respond and then
own you. Yeah.
Yeah. Own. Okay. Maybe. But I don't know. I don't know if that's, I'd more like to intellectually own somebody than just emotionally own somebody. But what I can comment or I think is more important is that the reaction to it is telling, right? You've got so many people who are now torn, who are thinking, oh, well, I thought, you know, I really like Musk because he is supporting my guy, or I really like my guy, and look, he's being supported by Musk, and now it's where do we land? And at the end of the day, I feel like we're all just pawns in kind of this oligarchical chess match that unfortunately, you know, impacts our personal lives and our dollars and cents more than we have any control over. And I don't know where you land on it, you know, personally, but from a 30,000-foot view, it doesn't look good for us as a whole.
Well, you remind me of that great line from Blazing Saddles. Mongo just pawn in Game of Life.
Exactly.
I mean, you're pitting the richest guy in the world aside from the oil oligarchs and kleptocrats in Russia and so forth. You're pitting the richest guy in the world against the most powerful guy in the world, and neither of them are known to have long fuses. Mm-hmm. So to me, and here's my opinion, they both have a lot of incentives to tone it down, and the incentives are greater for Musk once he comes down over whatever was prompting that. But I want to draw your attention to what you were underscoring, Jeff, about the budget deficits in this bill. The first thing is there's a lot of gimmicks in all of these bills.
Mm-hmm.
And the gimmick is that there's so-called 10-year scoring. And so all of these things expire, and some of them expire after 4 years, so the 10-year numbers won't look so bad. That's why all of these tax increases are set to come back in this year if they don't pass something, because in the first Trump bill, those tax cuts were set to expire in order to take advantage of that gimmick. Okay, so that's one thing. The second thing, which is that how big the deficits are really depend on what's called dynamic scoring. And what that means is if you think tax cuts will lead to a 2% growth rate in the economy, then that leads to one calculation about how big the deficits will be going forward if you pass the bill. But if you think it'll lead to 3% growth in the economy, the deficits are going to be a lot smaller. So who the heck knows? These are guesses. They may be better informed or less informed. Third point, if you don't pass it, there'll be a massive tax increase and a recession. That will lead to a catastrophe for the budget, but more importantly, a catastrophe for everyday American people. Yeah. And the final point I want to make, which I don't think anybody has made, is that this is the first time I've seen Republicans, since the days of Bob Dole, get interested in the deficit, other than a kind of gotcha game against Democrats when Democrats are in power and running deficits. So they'll always say, oh, they're killing us with the deficits. But then as soon as the Republicans get in power, they want to do deficit spending. This is the first time I've seen Republicans, other than Rand Paul, who's always against these. Right. But you're seeing Ron Johnson, a lot of other people, I think, are very concerned that the level of the deficits going forward. Just
Senator Lee of Utah. Yeah, there's a few.
So I think that's new. Don't you, John and Jeff?
Yes. I don't know. I don't mean to jump in here, Jeff. Do you have?
No, go for it. No, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, Lee has always kind of shadowed a lot of what Rand Paul has done in some of these things. Mm-hmm. But I think
conservative.
You're right. Right. Well, yeah, exactly. And I want to get to your piece John sent to me, and I missed it when it came out, but the two final battles of the culture war, when we get to it, but you made a great distinction there between Republicans and conservatives. There's kind of this disconnect within the party and these guys, this is kind of showing up now. But yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there's this realization that, you know, not the best interest is told to just keep spending. You know, we can't. You know, even though they want to, and it's easy to win political points, at the end of the day, we all lose because we're going to be broke.
My perspective is that as a father of two young conservative males, mm-hmm. I guess they would be called cis males or something like that.
Well, that's about their sexual preference, John. That's nothing to do with their politics.
Okay, they're conservatives. They vote Republican, mm-hmm. and they're thoroughly depressed with the guy that they want to be successful, who is President Trump.
Why are they depressed?
Because they see the debt deficit growing.
Right.
Becomes a number that they can't even imagine. It's like, $236 trillion. What is that? And it tells them that they won't be able to afford a home.
That is so interesting. And it will be interesting to see if and they also know that they're being screwed in Social Security.
Yeah.
Because the amount that they are paying in right now, they don't expect to receive. In fact, Social Security is supposed to run out, I think, within 10 years.
The only thing I don't want them to do is watch a DVD of Soylent Green. Because they might get some ideas.
DVD, John, you're aging yourself. Come on.
Something.
I do think that this difference between populism and conservatism shows up often on the Supreme Court. There is a problem among conservatives, not just a political problem, but a kind of ideological problem that's worth underscoring.
True.
And that is this. Conservatives want to conserve. They want stability. That doesn't mean complete stasis. They do want some changes and adaptation, but they favor the tried and true over the new and so forth. They favor things that we know work over things that might be an invention and that we try. And you can see why if you look back at the Lyndon Johnson's big programs, almost all of which failed, but which were tried in these huge budget-busting numbers all at once. I sometimes say that the problem with public housing under Lyndon Johnson wasn't that they built the Robert Taylor homes in Chicago and Pruitt-Igoe in St. Louis and so forth. It's that they built them all at once. They didn't build them in a few cities and see whether they worked or not. They would have quickly seen they didn't, and then they could move forward. The problem with most public policies is that we try them all at once, and some work and some don't, but then we're stuck. Obamacare. If they had just
Green New Deal, I mean, any of these things.
If they had tried some, you can't just try in a few places. I mean, if you roll out a new iPhone, it's got to be rolled out basically everywhere at once. If you roll out a new cereal, you can roll it out in Kansas City and Cincinnati and see whether people like it. But here's the problem. Since FDR, through Lyndon Johnson and even through Richard Nixon, and with the capstone being healthcare under Obama, there's been this vast increase in the scope of the federal government, in its centralization in Washington, and its centralization within Washington in the executive branch. So three huge changes in how America was governed traditionally. Okay.
Yeah.
Now,
from the Civil War. Thanks.
Right. Right.
Thanks, Lincoln.
Right. Exactly. So how do you change that if that's your goal, which many conservatives, it is the goal of many conservatives? Well, what Trump is saying is we can't just turn this big ship around very, very slowly. We have to make bigger changes. But once you start making bigger changes, which much of his populist coalition favors, you begin to undermine some of this fundamental conservative approach, which is do things slowly, see if they work, that sort of thing. So let me just give you an example. FEMA. Yeah. We know FEMA hasn't worked well. Okay, the FEMA really began with the great Mississippi River floods in the late 1920s. Herbert Hoover went down the Mississippi, saw how states like my native Mississippi were overwhelmed and couldn't deal with it. And that began the federal government's big engagement in flood control, which ultimately led to FEMA. But we saw in the case of FEMA dealing with all the flooding in North Carolina last year, that they were utterly feckless, ineffectual, unable to deal with it. And so what is Trump trying to do? He said, I still want all the money to come from the federal government, but I want local state agencies to handle the flood control. And that seems to me to be a kind of reasonable compromise, although it might take several years for states like North Carolina and Georgia, Florida, and so forth, to create the kind of local versions of FEMA that will handle this. But Trump is trying to turn this ship around, and it'll just remain to be seen if these local agencies do any better than the federal one. But we need to know. We need to find out if that's the case, and move forward with things that work. But there is a cleavage among Republicans in how fast we need to turn things around, with Trump saying, I only have not just 4 years, but probably only two, of which only maybe a little over a year remains before everybody goes away for re-election to the House. So he's trying to move fast because he wants to be a consequential president.
As a Republican, I hope that we can, out of the next few months, comes a strategy to elect more people like Johnson from Wisconsin and Mike Lee from Utah.
Lee is great.
And Rand Paul.
Lee is a really thoughtful guy.
I would like him to be on the Supreme Court, but he's too smart right now. You don't want to waste him, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, his father, Rex Lee, was the Solicitor General of the United States, which is the DOJ's lawyer before the Supreme Court. And Mike Lee is just as smart as his dad. My sense is that he won't get to the Supreme Court, both because Trump may not be, you don't see him in Trump's orbit, but also what I see is the desire to appoint younger people who will be on for a long time. And it'll be interesting to see if Alito and Thomas retire while Trump still has the Senate and can appoint their successors.
Well, one thing we do know is that the Federalist Society and Leonard Leo have lost great credibility and leverage with the Trump administration.
That's exactly what we were just talking about. Yeah. That's because the Federalist Society is truly conservative and not I mean, it's also broadened out, so there are a lot more people in it. But
I just think that he blames them for Amy Coney Barrett.
That's right. I think that you're right, and Kavanaugh too. There has been a fundamental change, though. I think in the Supreme Court, the only one who hasn't really changed in some ways is Roberts. And that the change is this, through Warren Berger and even later, the Supreme Court was really a policy-making body. If they didn't think a law comported with their view of what current liberal policies should be, even though some of these people were moderate conservatives, they just changed the law. They said a law was unconstitutional. And I think that the court now has moved much closer to an originalist position. That is, they look at the law, they look at the Constitution, and they say the new law that you're proposing or the administrative rule might be desirable, but that's not up to us to decide. The only thing we can decide is whether it meets constitutional muster, or in the case of a regulation, whether it needed to be passed by Congress. And they're doing that a lot more. And the reason I accepted Roberts is that I think his decisions on Obamacare and so forth were really designed to protect the court from the political onslaught that would have occurred, led only by Democrats, of course, if he had ruled that Obamacare was unconstitutional. I think he just thought he was protecting the court. Well, so he was looking for some way to find that it was constitutional.
Forgive me, gentlemen, but I want to slightly, if I may, slightly shift emphasis from what the professor is telling us regarding the Supreme Court and John and Roberts' decision to protect it at all costs. Mm-hmm. With the indictment of the Maryland man,
oy.
Abrego Kilmar, Abrego Garcia, who has been indicted on trafficking charges, sexual trafficking charges, drug charges, a huge indictment. I I suggest everyone read it, or if you can, before you comment on it. But I guess you guys, you're exempted, guys, because I know you know the issues. But here's the thing. When he is kept alive, or his chances at freedom are kept alive by the Democrats who made him their demigod or their hero, the Maryland man, all the media shouting, the Maryland man, the Maryland man, and accusing Tom Homan of what? Of being a copper. And now we see this. So in that contest of what Charles Lipson was saying, and Roberts's concern about the protection of the Supreme Court and the, the culture should protect and revere the Supreme Court. How does that fit?
You want to go with that, Jeff?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I don't necessarily, and you know, forgive my ignorance, I don't see necessarily. I see it as protecting the Supreme Court in the sense that, you know, rolling back to the original deportation, there was a judicial ruling that kept him in the country, and he may or may not have been a CI, you know, an informant, and there was some you know, jurisprudence that said he was okay to stay in the country until this was sorted out, whatever, and then him being ripped out of the country was against that order, and so now he's being brought, and now new charges. I mean, these are charges that are being brought new, recently, meaning that now, since these charges are going through, there should be some sort of due process because the last order said he was okay to be here. So it becomes this tangled web of judicial, you know, orders. I think due process is a process that we should support because it doesn't move fast. Like we've talked about, this progressives, that it's dangerous and you can't, you know, unintended outcomes, which are, could be this, deporting somebody who has a legal order that is in process, all that. That stuff puts us in a position where we have to say, what is more important? Is it more important to be politically correct in a sense, you know, what the media is telling us, which I don't think should ever be true, or is it more important for us to go through the processes and ultimately find out the truth and say, yeah, okay, at the end of the day, the courts are going to rule that says this guy has done illegal things, he's in the country illegally, and he is of no benefit to society here, let's get him out of here. I think that's where I would lean towards. I want to step towards the process. I want to follow the process. And maybe the process is flawed. Well, then that's a different conversation that we need to have about how do we correct that process. And I don't see an instantaneous action as the solution to any of these problems.
Charles?
In my usual mealy-mouth way, I want to kind of agree with both of you on parts of this. So he was originally scheduled for deportation by a federal court or by some administrative court. And then that was paused because to deport him to that particular state, there was a gang that was still operating there that was not his gang. He was in a different gang. And right. So he would be at risk. And so you couldn't deport him because he would be at risk. That gang was then dismantled. And so that rule didn't apply anymore, but a court hadn't made that ruling. Okay. So, but the people who did the deporting said, okay, we think that that rule doesn't apply anymore. And so they went ahead and deported him. And at this point, the judge says, you got to bring him back. And the administration, the Trump administration, says, we can't bring him back. He's in another country subject to their jurisdiction, not ours. What do you want us to do? Send in the Marines?
Yeah.
And so the federal, it was appealed up to the Supreme Court, which it issued one of those Delphic rulings. That is, you can interpret it however you want, that said that the administration had to facilitate his return. Okay. And the administration says, hey, we're facilitating it. We've said, maybe it'd be good if he came back. But they actually didn't even say that. Okay.
That's the key. but that's like something for Mike Lee to deal with. Yeah.
So now, while he's down there,
mm-hmm.
the Democrats get all behind him. Another 80-20 issue, actually a 95.
Have some margaritas with him, yeah. Right.
Yeah, so Chris Van Hollen goes down there. And the argument, the Democrats' best argument, and it's one that I largely agree with Jeff on, is we have to adhere to due process because the president making decisions without the court being able to rule whether they were constitutional or proper is the road to tyranny, even if you agree with the substantive outcome. So, but the problem is when you go down and meet with Abrego Garcia, you end up looking, and your earlier policy is that we have no objection to the borders being completely open, and yeah. we won't even call people who are in the country illegal immigrants. We'll just call them undocumented, right. and we're not going to do anything about it. And you go down there and meet with Abrego Garcia, you end up undermining you of your two arguments. The due process one doesn't look like it's the one you're emphasizing. If that's the one you're emphasizing, you would stand in front of the Supreme Court, not have a margarita with the bad guy. So now that they can see that they've just been whiplashed over that, the Democrats right. have come back to the argument that Jeff made, which is correct. I'm not saying Jeff made was one of the people making the bad argument. I'm saying right. Jeff made the correct argument that there are due process rights. Well, now they brought him back in, and they're going to make these arguments in court against him. And that's smart. They waited until the issue had died down, so it didn't. So this is typical Trump administration. It didn't look like they were caving to the Democrats, right? Mm-hmm. And then they bring him back, which looks like it's under their own decision. And the longer they keep this case in the public eye, the worse it is for Democrats.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm going to pull the right of personal privilege here.
Sure.
Since I brought this up, I'm just going to mention a couple things. Number one, there are three, I don't know how much time we have to dicker about how many angels there are on the head of a pin when we have hundreds of thousands, literally 200 or 300,000 children that are missing.
Right.
But that came up from the border illegally, that the Joe Biden administration stupidly let through and without vetting.
Purposefully.
Because they wanted to overthrow the United States as we know it. And I blame that completely on Obama people because, well, that's just Obama's way. And we have the children are lost. He is an MS-13 gang member. He has transported thousands of undocumented immigrants.
Sex trafficking.
Including children. Yeah. Sex trafficking, firearms, drugs. He abused the female migrants that were in his care, and he is linked to that incident in Mexico, in the tractor trailer. You hear about that, guys?
No, yeah. I didn't.
He's linked to an incident in Mexico where a tractor trailer overturned and killed 50 migrants, and I think they basically suffocated in the heat of that tractor trailer.
God. Oh, how awful.
Yeah. And they don't care about our human life. They don't care about the sanctity of life. They don't care about the children. Even the Democrats and the Republicans who are arguing, if you care, if they were your kids, you would lock him in a room with me and a burlap bag and a 50-gallon drum of water.
So, you know, it's interesting.
Because the children are dying.
Absolutely. I find that some of the positions on the left are so strange.
Why is
to
that?
To take a very different one, transgender in sports.
Oh, yeah, another one.
But I want to link the two. It's like once a position gets defined as a very strong, high-profile leftist position, like transgenders in sports, right. Even people who were feminists who right. should be supporting only biological women right. in sports, which is not to say you should be against transgender adults if that's how they want to express themselves.
Who is, for God's sake, nobody?
You can be right. against permanent changes for children. That yeah. seems to me to be child abuse. If you're doing these things permanently, if you're not allowed to operate heavy equipment, how can you right. make life choices?
They can't access porn online, but they can, you know, have their lives changed.
Here's the question for the paper that I assigned you guys in this class. Why are the Democrats wedded to 80-20 issues when they know they're not successful?
I have an answer to that before I put that prompt into AI. and the answer is, let me start with an analogy.
All right.
When George Wallace first ran for office in Alabama, he lost. He was a populist who was hoping to build a black-white coalition. We think of him as just a racist.
Yeah.
But that was not his initial position. And after he lost, and the same had happened earlier around the turn of the century, to a guy named Tom Watson in Georgia. I think it was Wallace who said, "I'm not going to be out N-word again." In other words, I'm not going to let my opponents charge me as an N-lover and damn me this way.
Mm-hmm.
And to go to the current, I think a lot of people who are part of a progressive coalition, once an issue is identified as further left, they're very reluctant to have somebody say you're a right winger for opposing that. I mean, look at how they've damned J.K. Rowling for opposing transgenders in sports.
Trying to destroy her.
So they're trying to destroy her. And once you see that, A, you don't want to be destroyed, but B, you begin to think, well, maybe this transgender issue is further left, and I'm more a leftist than I am a feminist. And so I think again and again on migration and those kinds of issues, they've been trapped into that. But why? But let's not forget that Trump is a very shrewd politician, and he's pushed them into it. So they're also going to be on the opposite side of any issue that Trump is for, right? They're going to be against it.
Mm-hmm.
As Groucho Marx once sang in one of his 1930s movies, whatever it is, I'm against it. And that's their view toward Trump policies. So as soon right. as Trump says, I'm against transgender women in sports, a lot of people on the other side say, I'm going to be against it. So he traps them smartly for a politician into these issues. I think it's a I don't think that they can easily escape from that. And you can see it in California right now. To return to where we began as our mm-hmm. conclusion, you can see that the fact that Trump is in favor of law and order and in favor of deporting illegal immigrants, especially violent ones, has put Democrats in the position that they kind of wanted to be anyway. They want to oppose Trump. They want to favor the so-called undocumented, and they don't want the federal government to come in and enforce law and order. So they end up on the side of an issue that I think is just going to kill them.
Well, there's no, apparently there's no downside to that as far as they're concerned. I mean, they're supportive. For example, this one, you know, we had the issue just a few days ago recently in Boulder, Colorado, when the psycho Egyptian tried to burn Jews, and the Democrats, some made pro forma denouncing of, burning Jews is the wrong thing to do. But really, they kind of left it alone because they did not want to risk losing their votes. They didn't want to risk their base.
Yeah, I think their main opposition was that it put hydrocarbons into the atmosphere.
I can say, as somebody who, you know, was born in the 80s, grew up in the late 80s and 90s.
You're such a kid. Yeah.
I know I am. And I talk about it all the time. It's this idea of the progressive Olympics that we've been conditioned through those generations to through the media, through, you know, social media. I mean, if you come out and say you're pro everything, all these groups, you get likes, you get shared, you get, oh my God, look how great and brave they are. And the media supports that. And then it becomes a cyclical event where it's the more you are, the more popular you are, you know, the more better you are, the more you're like everybody else wants to be. And I want to be idealist and all this stuff. And I think that's where our culture is, and that, you know, our culture needs to have a changing moment to see the kind of foolishness and the sheep mentality of that ism, because we're going to keep getting to these places where we get to these, you know, we're defending human traffickers and illegal people who are causing havoc in our streets and people who are standing in the way of, you know, police arresting really bad people and deporting really bad people. And I don't think we get to that point unless there is some large counteraction, counterforce.
I think that counteraction is happening now. And all I would say is that The Democrats and especially the far left progressives who are supporting this are beginning to look more and more like those old pictures of Saint Jerome, where he has nothing but arrows in him from all over the place. Right. I think we're at a moment of cultural change, and I'm delighted to have been with you, John.
Those are self-inflicted arrows.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's right. these are boomerang arrows. Right. But I think that this is a moment in which on campus there's been less pushback. They're on elite campuses, most of the students just keep their heads down. But I think you're seeing people voting with their feet. They're moving mm-hmm. They're sending their children to universities where this won't happen. But I think we're at a moment of cultural conflict, but also conflict in the streets. And I would like to see some, not only the bad guys arrested for these violent protests, but I'd like to see some RICO charges for the people who are funding them.
I want RICO charges too. Can they apply to the government of Iran? Because
is another big issue that we will have to talk about, it because it's just a big issue, and they're clearly trying to play what in the old days before the 24-second clock was instituted in basketball. They're playing the four-corner offense to run out the clock. It's great to be with you guys.
Thank you, Charles. Always an honor.
And for Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, the Peter B. Ritzma Chair at the University of Chicago, for Jeff Carlin, Executive Producer, WGN Radio, friend of cats, baker of pies, married to the lovely Christine. And for me, John Cass, book thief. What else am I? Bad boy at Greek school. Yeah, there's a lot you can blame me on.
Killer of crows.
Hunter of crows. Join us again next time on another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.